Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. For this season 4 finale episode of the podcast, my guest is one of the most important figures in British comedy of the last 50 years. His work has won him 3 BAFTAs, being behind and or involved in the creation of programmes that rank among the greatest examples of their genre. We're talking QI, Blackadder, Spitting Image, The News Quiz, To the Manor Born, Come Outside, Not the 9 O'Clock News, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Have I Got News for You, and so much more. He is to British broadcasting what Kevin Bacon is to the movies. Think of any production. If he didn't create it, he's very likely helped produce it, and if he wasn't involved, he's never more than about 1 or 2 handshakes away. The extensiveness of his CV is pretty appropriate given how much we spoke about holism, the idea that everything is somehow connected during our near 90-minute chat in Edinburgh during the Fringe, my 3rd time at the festival, his 39th. I've introduced a few of these interviews with the phrase, our far-reaching conversation, and never has it been more true than with my chat with John. The topics we discussed in my Grass Market studio flat back in August include, but are by no means limited to, QI, educational reform, producing, directing, Navajo proverbs, Douglas Adams, mysticism, humanity, with both a big H and a little H, rejected plotlines from the Johnny English films, the real answer to life, the universe and everything, Jeff Goldblum and why being fired can be a very good thing indeed. And so, for one last time this year, let's get straight into it. Please welcome my guest for the Spieling the Beans Season 4 finale episode, the father of QI himself, John Lloyd, CBE. John Lloyd, thank you so much for speaking to me today on Spieling the Beans.
Pleasure.
I'd like to begin with a question I normally end these with, which is, why do we need stories?
There's a Dutch poet, I think, called Muriel Rijkerser, who says the universe is made of stories, not of atoms. I think there's something, I've never been asked this question before, but it's one of the core mysteries, I think. Why stories? You know, like, why comedy? Why music? Why art? Why consciousness? Why is there something, not nothing? So I don't know the answer, but it's very compelling, isn't it? A story is the way to get across information best, really, and it seems to resonate emotionally for reasons I don't really understand. I think it's, I guess if I really had to put out there, I'd say what we're doing is we're hunting for the actual story. There is the one story, whatever that is, where we came from, where we're going, who we are. And all the stories are a little hint of what the big story actually is. And of course, most people, as somebody said, most people die with their music still locked up inside them. And I think most people don't find what the story is. And when you pass to the other side, I believe you wake up and you go, oh, brilliant. Brilliant. That is so clever. Mm. It's the punchline.
Mm. I love that. So would you agree then we are the stories we tell ourselves?
Yeah, I think we all tell ourselves who we are and repeat. This is what I'm doing here in Edinburgh, is telling stories about me and what happened to me. And again, by telling the story truthfully, you find a kind of universality in people. 2 people came up afterwards and said, I had this question about what noises would you quieten in the world and what would you amplify? Mm-hmm. And the 2 things I said I would quieten was that you need a mute button for the Tory leadership candidates and also the voices in my head. I'd like those to shut up. Mm-hmm. And that was what really got these 2 people. Then suddenly they were on side. They think, I'm with this guy. Rather than, you know, the many jokes that I'm telling, a joke is a joke, but a truth is really something special. And of course, all the great jokes are also truthful in a strange way.
Mm, completely. You've mentioned your show here at The Fringe. It's your, I think, the 39th year of being at The Fringe, is that right?
Yeah.
Next year is the 40th?
Yeah.
What has been the biggest change you've seen in the last 39 years?
Well, it just got so enormous. I mean, you know, in 1973 when I came, or 76 when I brought my first show up here with Douglas Adams, mm-hmm. we used to have a little card table and we sold tickets from the street on the Royal Mile, outside a little close called Brodie's Close, and we sold out. It's only 90-seater, but... And you could get to know more or less everybody, really. You could get round the fringe and see the sort of key stuff, and you can't possibly do that now. Mm-hmm. It's massive. And, of course, it's spread, the audience is spread more thinly, so... Whereas when I did two one-man shows in 2013 and 2015, 200-seater, they sold out every single night. And now I'm in a 400-seater, and I don't think we've had more than 50 people. But it's great, actually. It's really intimate because people feel, rather than being, you know, just a number in a vast crowd of faces, they're actually individual people, and you have this wonderful connection. You can see everybody's faces. And so it's more like a dialogue than a lecture or a show. Mm. Really, really enjoyable to do, and good for me. Because you get, because it's different every day, and you don't know what's going to come up. You get tremendous surprises, and it's very freeing for me because I'm a pedantic, you know, OCD sort of spectrum-y kind of fanatic about detail. I like to get everything absolutely right and perfectly prepared, and I can't do that. So. It's actually very liberating.
Fantastic. And I imagine that having a sort of a more intimate environment is exactly what people are craving 2 years after the sort of the anonymous sort of watching of media and content and entertainment, to have that human connection, particularly after what everyone has been through. It just increases that sort of that desire and that sort of joy of having that human connection.
Yeah. I mean, there's something peculiar about Zoom calls, isn't there? It's both kind of sterile and strangely too intimate, you know. Mm. People scratch their bottoms and eat curry while they're talking to you, or turn up in their pants, whereas there's no real substitute for being able to touch somebody on the elbow, or you know it's curious why it makes such a difference. I don't know.
Mm. And I've noticed a few comedians talking about when they've had therapy on Zoom, it kind of breaks the illusion that you need, that the therapist has their life together. And if you see that their Christmas tree is still up in March, that is a problem. You mentioned there your very first show with Douglas Adams, of which I, as billions of other, am a colossal fan. Hitchhiker's Guide, as I mentioned, is the class reader of my class. And whenever someone asks what's my favourite book, it's that one. I didn't realise quite how close you were before I sort of got deep into the research. What was he like as both a flatmate and a colleague?
Well, he was my best friend. You know, we were very, very close. And we started going out just to chat. I didn't know him very well at university. But and we used to go to a hamburger joint called Tootsie's in Notting Hill, or Holland Park, and, you know, drink far too much and laugh and swap ideas. And then eventually we end up sharing a flat and then a house in Roehampton with a mad guitarist called Gibson, I remember.
Not the inventor of the guitar.
No, just a coincidence. And... so Douglas was, like many people, but so everything Douglas did was bigger than life. He was bigger than life. You know, his beard was enormous. When he had an accident, it was insane. It was like, you know, he'd had a huge laugh. When he coughed, it was like a volcano spluttering at you. Mm-hmm. And he was very funny, but very unself-aware, really. I'm physically clumsy and emotionally clumsy. You know, he would do things and break things and fall off things. And the same with his relationships with people. He wasn't a bad bone in his body, but he was very unaware of the sort of waterspout havoc that he wrought as he shunted through life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting about the books because... Particularly, I think, is like, particularly the first two are so good.
Mm.
But if you had seen him working or trying to work, you think there's no way this guy's even going to complete the first chapter. I mean, it was all, he agonized over the first paragraph and the first chapter. He'd take a year doing that.
Mm.
And then he'd have to be either bullied or blackmailed by his publisher into finishing it. And he would finish the whole book in literally hours. There was one he wrote, wow, he finished on a plane to Malaysia or somewhere like that, you know, in about 11 hours, uh-huh, 15 hours or something like that. And, you know, it's kind of, this is the thing that interests me, is that where does creativity come from? And my son's a songwriter, he's called Waiting for Smith, mm-hmm, and he doesn't really claim to write the songs. He sort of channels them, and most good songwriters, Elton John, Noel Gallagher, Mozart, have all been quoted as saying, you know, I don't write the songs, they just come through me.
Yeah.
So Noel Gallagher said on his Des Done This, I think, that he feels as a man with a bucket up in the sky full of songs, which he just empties into his head. And I think that's what Douglas did. When he was conscious and thinking, oh, I can't do this, I'm hopeless, you know, his notebooks, which are in the archive at Cambridge University now, are full of notes to himself saying, I'm hopeless, I wish I'd never started this, how did I think I could be a writer? But when he let go, the truth of the universe funneled through him, you know, without him getting in the way. And it's rather like the show that I'm doing, which is, it's not improv, but it's a Q&A, so I don't know what to expect. You can do minimal prep. And so when you're lucky, you say things or things occur to you. You know, you have callback jokes or whatever that it's not me. It's, you know. So I think it's, you know, going back to the stories, it's, there's only one anything really, you know. There are theories that just as, you know, a single cell of the human body contains the information for the whole body. You know, you can get a stem cell and create, you know, all the information is packed into that single tiny object. And some people think that the one human body contains the information for the entire universe, the code for the whole universe. Yeah. So, and I think it's a good way of looking at life, is that it's a solipsistic universe. If you think you're actually the only real person here, and it's your journey, it's the story of you. A lot of things become sort of easier to deal with. Or alternatively, which is also true, the universe is built on paradox, as you may know. Niels Bohr, the great Danish scientist, used to say, at last, gentlemen, we have encountered a paradox, now we have some hope of making progress. So when you find a paradox, it's usually a truth. So that I believe that the central paradox for human beings is it's not about you, mate. Mm-hmm. It's not about you. On the other hand, it is all about you. Your journey is to become the person you potentially can become and no other. All the other things don't matter. The prizes, you know, the money, the marriages, the kind of the acclaim, what other people think of you, none of those things matter. It's just to kind of get to a place where you are. You overcome the appalling initial conditions with which we are all saddled. Mm. And Douglas had worse than most. And there's a paradox, you know, for somebody who was in many ways personally a mess to produce these pearls, these extraordinary gifts to the rest of us is there's a paradox for you, you know.
Mm. There's a Navajo proverb that you say you live your life by. Everything easy is evil, everything difficult is good, and it seems to fit into that incredibly well.
Well, I think, I mean, obviously, it's a brilliant line. Mm-hmm. It makes you think, like all good proverbs should. It's not, I suppose, universally true in the sense, for example, I don't find it difficult to make really good scrambled eggs. They just have to be exactly so, but that's about paying close attention. So it's people who think scrambled eggs are easy are mistaken. You can't just stick them in the pan and then take them out 10 minutes later. They'll be not very nice. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you watch them like a hawk, as they say, and your timing is impeccable. So it's not difficult, mm-hmm, but it's not exactly easy either. But I definitely think that quality, truth, lies the other side of difficulty. And a metaphor I often use is that life is like you're driving down a road and the road is blocked by endless series of ramparts and walls and potholes, huge obstacles. You think, I'm never going to get to the end of the road here. But if you, you know, are courageous and determined and you carry on regardless. When you look in the rearview mirror behind you, you see they're just speed bumps. That's all. They weren't. The idea that they were ramparts is entirely an illusion.
I came and saw you when you were, I think, promoting Afterlif in around 2012, 2013 to the Sherborne Literary Festival.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember...
yeah, Douglas's family were all there.
Was that true?
Yeah.
I'd forgotten that if I knew that at the time. And you said a story which has stuck with me ever since, which I thought it was, from your perspective, in research I found it's from Richard Curtis's perspective, of a particular lunch that he had with Douglas.
Yeah.
Seemingly the one person who could have found the answer to life, the universe and everything, did. For those who don't know the story, would you mind telling a précis of it?
Richard Curtis, the great screenwriter and good friend, told me this story, which is he'd agreed to have lunch with Douglas and they decided they would have a jolly, gossipy lunch and too much to drink and have a laugh, you know. Mm-hmm. And they're walking to the restaurant down the road, and Richard says, how are you, Douglas? And Douglas goes, that's a frown he used to do. He said, careworn and world-weary. He said, you know, it's rather odd, Richard. I think I might have actually discovered what the meaning of everything is, the answer to life, the universe, and everything. And Richard goes, blimey. And he thinks, the little man in his head thinks, okay, I've come to a fork in the road here. I can either go, oh my God, Douglas, you've discovered the secret of the universe, which will mean then Douglas will go on for, you know, hours and hours about stuff that's too difficult to understand, lots of science and, you know, probably quoting Richard Dawkins and he won't stop, you know, he's unstoppable when he got on a theme. Mm-hmm. And he'll use up the whole lunch and we won't have any jokes or any gossip or anything and I won't get anything out of him. Alternatively, I could just say, oh, really, Douglas? And how's Jane, who was his girlfriend, then later wife? And to his eternal shame, Richard opted for the latter. And so he said, oh, really, Douglas? And how's Jane? And Douglas goes, oh, you know, she's all right. Fine. Oh, here's the restaurant. And they, the awful thing about it was that 6 months later, Douglas died in a gym in California, aged only 49, and so his secret died with him, whatever it was. Anyone else, you know, you think, well, obviously they've gone mad, but with Douglas, it was eminently possible that he really had come across the secret, whatever it is. So it's a wonderful, it's a good story, isn't it? It's mysterious.
Yeah. Did he ever sort of, with it, thinking back, as you will have done the last decade or two, any hints as to what it might have been? Any sort of thing like, sort of, ideas he was pontificating about and going, oh, that could be the answer? Or...
Something you said there reminded me of, there's a wonderful physicist and philosopher called David Bohm, who wrote an amazing book called Wholeness and the Implicate Order, and his idea is that that things are actually connected beneath in some ways. As we said, there's really only one thing and everything else is an expression of this kind of singularity, this dimensionless point. And he was working on that and he was in his lab or office late one night and he phoned his wife to say, hey, I'm going to come home. I think I've solved it. I think I've worked it all out. And he died, you know, on the way home. So, I mean, I think it's, for me, everything's explicable. You know, everything is reasonable and rational. Doesn't look like it, but that's part of the journey. But in Buddhism, you know, Buddha says in life there are certain things that are not important. Why is there a universe at all, for example? How old is it? Those things don't matter. Or because it's your story that you need to solve. All the other stuff is clutter, you know. I remember being interviewed right at the beginning of QI by a guy from the Times. And, you know, I discovered all these things that I didn't know at whatever I was by then, pushing 50. Mm-hmm. You know, the life cycle of the eel, the kind of just the, let's say, quantum entanglement, for example, that you can get two subatomic particles that are in some way connected. push them a million miles apart, you twist one and the other one twists the other way, as if there's no intervening distance or time, mm-hmm. these sort of mysteries. And so I was going on about it, and clearly this man who's a showbiz writer, called Andrew Billen, as it happens, who's a very nice guy, clearly thought I'd gone raving. You know, he thought, this guy's, where are the jokes here, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, there were jokes as well, because QI is full of them, but because the universe is naturally funny, which is another thing we don't really understand. Anyway, suddenly something clicks with QI. Sometimes people go, this is ludicrous, and then they suddenly get it. Mm-hmm. They sort of, enlightenment floods upon them. They go, this is an amazing idea. This is like such a simple formula for existence.
Yeah.
And he said, out of the blue, why do you think the universe is so interesting? And without thinking about it, I said, I think for two reasons. One is to lead us to ask the core questions that are really important. There are only two of them, which is, why are we here and what should we do about it? And the other reason it's so interesting is so interesting to distract us from ever finding the important questions. Mm-hmm. Because most of your life is you're nerdling around, aren't you? You know, you're like building an enormous thing out of matchsticks for no particular reason, and one day it all stops and the electricity turns off and you're not there anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think very few people are able to see past the clutter. It's, you know, it's a wood from the trees problem, you know. Mm-hmm. That people are obsessed not just by the individual trees, but by the leaves and the veins on the leaves and trunk and the bark and all this kind of thing. And they don't see, if they could only just get a sort of drone's eye view. There it is. It's just one thing. Mm-hmm. And we're all part of that. Is this too mystical for you, Dom?
No, I'm loving it. Hmm. It relates a lot. I was thinking a lot about Dirk Gently and holistic detectives and how everything, you know, connects there along with that. And when you're talking about trees, I was listening to the interview you gave with Sue Gidroch, just combine the two, Sue Perkins, about the secret life of trees and how...
I was obsessed about it at that time, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. I have one more question on Hitchhiker's Guide before we move on to other topics, which is growing up surrounded by the fandom from my earliest teens and the lore around it, L-O-R-E, there's the story of what I think is the one of the finest examples of English literature is the Bowl of Petunias scene, which I actually wrote down so I didn't get it wrong, with the Bowl of Petunias and the whale heading towards the ground, and the Bowl of Petunias thinking, the only thought that went through its mind, oh no, not again. That scene, I had heard on the grapevine, about 13 years old, that the recording was going on, and you and Douglas and someone in the back room had like another 8 minutes to fill, and were quickly scribbling it down and handing the papers as it was being read out live. Is that apocryphal, or was it sort of onto the wire? We need another couple of minutes. The Bowl of Petunias.
Well, that wouldn't have been there. I wasn't really involved in the production.
Okay.
It would have been Douglas around the back. Yeah, okay. He was turning it out almost live.
So it sounds like it could well be.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, that's closed a mystery that I've had for the past.
I was going to say that I think if I ever get round to writing the four novels that I've been sitting on for nearly 30 years.
Yeah.
The dedication at the front, the sort of, there's a word, isn't there, for a quote at the front of a book?
Yes, well, not prologue, but epigraph?
Might be an epigraph, yes, that sounds good. It would be this quote from Douglas Adams, which I think is the best line he ever wrote, which is, there is a theory that if anyone ever discovers why the universe is here and what it is for, it will instantly be replaced by something even more bizarre and inexplicable. There is a second theory that this has already happened. I think that's the case. I think that if anybody does discover, it will just poof, and a more complicated puzzle. And that's really what my novels are about, ultimately. People sometimes say, well, what are the books about? I don't know if I'll ever get round to writing them, but the thought is that if Douglas had lived till now, this is the book that he might have been able to write, because we were very young when he wrote Hitchhiker.
Mm-hmm.
you know, in our 20s, and didn't know anything. But we were, both of us, Douglas particularly, extremely imaginative and puzzled by things, interested in why things were so. And so what happens with Hitchhiker, rather like Douglas asks all the big questions, really. They're all hidden away in the text, but he doesn't have any of the answers. So he does a thing and it ends with a joke. He asks the question and then there's a very funny twist on it. And what the absurd ambition of my stuff is to say, is to answer some of those questions in a way which is equally entertaining but compelling, and maybe help people to negotiate their lives a little bit more easily.
I really hope you wrote those. They sound phenomenal. And when you do, please come back on the show and we'll discuss them further detail. You mentioned earlier on about your son Harry and Waiting for Smith. I'm a huge fan. It's a phenomenal.
Oh, are you?
I am.
Amazing.
I am. Roma, I particularly love. And Long Life, I believe it's called. And there's a lyric in Long Life: "Try variety and sample every grain of rice." And that seems to sum up your attitude to life and also education. That it's in the trial of every aspect of it that you create the sort of most holistic individual. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, you're a teacher, and I think that primary school teaching on the whole is very good, and children like school when they're small, because it's not so much, well, it's getting there, but it's not so much pressure. It's not about results. It's about fun and understanding and engagement. And you know, most primary school teachers, you probably teach more or less anything, any subject?
The vast majority.
Yeah. And that's the way people should be taught. It's like life. I mean, you know, life doesn't work like a broadcast schedule. You know, it's not half an hour is funny and then half an hour is interesting and half an hour is informational. And same with school subjects. You know, life doesn't divide itself into 40 minutes of French and then 40 minutes of maths. It's an absurd way of doing it. Is one of the themes of the book that I haven't written, is that there's a big university where everything is taught in a cross-generic way. And that's the way I would, if I had a QI school, and it's something we've wanted to do since it started. You know, one day there will be a QI school somewhere where every lesson will begin with something interesting and usually funny, where all the kids go, wow, that's amazing. Lots of teachers, if you haven't discovered them yet, Dom, go and get our fact books.
I have.
Okay. Do you use those in lessons?
I'm just about to go in. I was online tutoring. I'm now going into school, and they're one of my earliest purchases.
Okay. So, what these are is they're not just books. They look like books, but they're four facts a page, and all the facts are strangely connected to the next one. So it's like a sort of strange picaresque story.
Yeah.
And if you go online and you dial in. The first book is called 1227 Facts, QI Facts. You go online, you go qi.com/1227, and there's a source finder. So if you've got a fact like, try and think of one offhand that I can remember. It's so difficult to remember QI Facts, there's so many of them.
Should I give you a subject and you think of a fact?
Well, no, for example, there'll be the centre of the universe. Smells like rum and tastes like raspberries. You think, what? And you go and look it up and you'll find an article in Scientific American about spectroscopy and all that kind of stuff. And it's particularly good for secondary schools because kids get to be teenagers, they get grumpy, they get confused, they start asking questions, they're bored a lot of the time. And this is a great way to get their attention. So the teacher starts with a great fact about something even vaguely related to the subject. And the kids go, what's that, miss? What's that? And she has read up the article before, and so she can talk intelligently about how we know that the centre of the galaxy smells like rum. And those kids will never forget that fact. And once you've told one particular funny story, they laugh and they're interested. And those teachers, I have people stop me in the street, say I'm the most popular teacher in my school because I use your books in lessons all the time. And it's such a simple thing. And I believe in modern educational theory, each teacher is supposed to have a thing called a hook where they do exactly that. I didn't know this when we started. where they start with something interesting to get people's attention.
Yeah.
But how's a teacher going to do that? They've been marking all night. You know, they're very tired. You know, they're mainly trying to keep order a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And where do they get the information from, you know? Well, the answer is QI. It's really simple. Mm. It's a very cheap way of getting popular.
That's a hell of a slogan. And absolutely, and it entirely mirrors my approach to education in that for years I've been saying that if you hate maths, it's because you had a terrible maths teacher. If you hate history, it's because you had a terrible history teacher. And I found that you share that view identically in previous interviews. And particularly with primary school teaching, because you're teaching the vast majority of it, I view it as you're the embodiment of education. And I feel like you can pick up the details later and you can teach anyone the 8x table in about 45 minutes. But what you need to do is get them driven to learn and get that sort of spark of, oh, I want to find out more about this stuff. And it seems to fit entirely with the QI ethos.
No, absolutely. We call it teaching upside down, is that if you get the kids interested, I mean, everybody's born curious. It's beaten out of them at school and by their parents. Mm-hmm. You know, my father used to say, look it up. And if you get people interested, they'll teach themselves. Somebody said, all you need to do to educate a child is teach them to read. Everything else is brainwashing.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, apart from the two or three great teachers some of us are lucky enough to have, all the things that I know how to do really well, I've learned for myself. Mm-hmm. And the same for Harry, you know. Harry hated music lessons at school. He taught himself off YouTube and talking to friends. And similarly, all the things I learned to do, I've never had a directing lesson, you know. I don't have a media degree. I learned to direct ads by doing it, you know, and making mistakes and, I'll do that better. Yeah, so any proper teaching is self-teaching, and the teacher should really be a kind of shepherd, is to sort of light the fire in the brain so that people do it for themselves, and then they can take the afternoon off. They put their feet up and read a book.
Yeah.
Rather than saying shut up, say no, wrong, sit down. You know, it's hopeless. I mean, there are so many hopeless things in society which we do wrong. Prison, for example, is a completely futile, pointless, very expensive waste of time and money for everybody, and it's just, if anything, counterproductive. Just makes the situation worse.
Totally. I remember Stephen Fry said a story of how he met a former prisoner, and he said, "Oh, the problem is, prisons today are not a deterrent. When I first went to prison, then it was a deterrent."
Really?
Yes, apparently. As in, sort of, that when I first went to prison, it was not when Stephen Fry went to prison.
No,
he was told this story by a former prisoner that saying that, oh, the problem today is that it's no longer a deterrent. When I first went to prison, then it was a deterrent, meaning that it didn't indeed work.
Oh yes, that's very good. Oh yes, so you're still a prisoner.
I couldn't have mangled that better.
Yeah.
But, you know.
No, I get you. I couldn't. Yeah, no, it's one of the things that as a parent, I think. I come to the conclusion that punishment of all forms is completely futile. That is not the solution to anything. You know, when I was punished, when I was beaten at school, it just left me with a hatred and resentment of authority wrongly wielded, and it never stopped me doing anything. Mm. Why do it? And it, you know, I think again, these are all metaphors. Prison, punishment. These are all metaphors for what the great story is. I mean, I think that it's what a thing that Billy Connolly and I share as philosophers is that we're all in prison here. That's what the thing is. We've for something that we don't know what it is we've done. And I also think another metaphor is life is a hard exam that we didn't realize we even signed up for. And at the end you hear the dread words, "Stop writing, please."
There's a question I always ask these interviews, which is, did you have a teacher at school that particularly inspired you? And for you, it seems like it was a gentleman called Mike Pike.
Oh, yeah, Mike Pike, what a cool dude, yeah. He walked like a cowboy, you know, and he taught, well, me anyway, maths and kind of geopolitics. It was extraordinary to think that at the age of 10 or 11, I think, he was telling us about the Vietnam War, which was then, let's think, 11, that would have been 62. Mm-hmm. So it was the French then, before the Americans had got involved. And he had a relief map of Vietnam, and we could have given a talk on the situation in Indochina. Absolutely fascinating. And as for maths, you know, I am a numerate. Harry, my son, is a very good mathematician, but very dyslexic. And I'm a word person, and I don't get numbers. I mean, reading a budget or a balance sheet makes me feel physically ill. But Mike Pike used to teach, it's how he taught us binary. Again, to be able to know binary in 1962 was extremely unusual. Mm-hmm. I mean, computers were the size of a house, you know. Mm-hmm. And how he taught us binary was to play this game called NIM, where you take a bunch of objects, coins, Smarties, matchsticks, whatever, you, and put them into random piles on a table. And you, each move, it's a two-person game, each person has to take some matches from one, you have to choose a pile and take some matches from all of them to just one from each pile. And then the other person has the other go. And the object is to make the other person pick up the last object. Mm-hmm. And you can only do this if you know binary in your head, because what you have to do is convert the decimal numbers of the pile, the number of matches in the pile, into binary. Mm-hmm. And then you've got to add up all the piles like that, all of them into binary, and you have to leave the other person with an even number in binary converted to decimal again. So if it's 0111 0111, and then you add that up in as if it were a decimal number, and you have to leave an even number, 22411, and not one, that would be uneven. So they've all got to be even. And so as a result of that, I used to win money with friends, and so did when I taught it to Harry when he was 11. He went to school, and you can win a lot of money because people can't believe it's not random.
Yeah.
They think, give me another go. Give me another go.
So the reverse of the hot hand fallacy of that if you score two shots in the basketball hoop, you're going to get the third one. You have the reverse sort of the gambler's addiction of like, no, I can't lose another time.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to have to win eventually.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was very inspiring. And I had two English teachers at King's Canterbury, where I was Rasper Purnell, as he's known, because he used to talk like that. If you're going to write a book, write about yourself. He was brilliant. Then there was another guy called Mr. O'Dwyer, who was an English teacher who got me into acting in a big way. He was amazing. Never seen any of them since. I nearly saw Mike Pike a while back, but I never got around to it, which is a shame.
I had a similar teacher called Mr. PC, Mr. Pendergudlip, who was seemed about 8 foot tall. And he'd had a stroke earlier on, but always insisted on playing the dame in the pantomime and would do the makeup himself. He said he was the smartest teacher in the school by far. Sort of could have been an Oxford Don if he wanted, but he wanted to just go into sort of provincial school. And he always said that if you can teach me something, that's fantastic. And it showed that you don't have to be proprietary about or possessive about intelligence, and sort of you don't have to be worried about being shown to be ignorant. Mm. Education can continue throughout life, which again feeds back, I guess, into the
key. Yeah, I mean, I honestly believe that you know, every teacher should learn something every lesson,
and
you should. You shouldn't be frightened of children asking questions. You should be encouraging. What do you think? And because then you really will. You'll both learn something. You'll find, because nobody can know even the smallest part of everything, of anything. And it's, yeah. But most teachers are frightened of that, because what if they don't know the answer?
Yes, and you've.
I mean, I'll tell you again. It's. My children have taught me everything I know that's useful, and I often refer to Harry, where his story. So early on in QI, I just discovered that, as far as we know, Earth is the only place in the certainly in the solar system that has tectonic plates, mm-hmm. and there's a mystery why we don't know. Some people say it's because of all the water. It's like the sort of mantle of the Earth is like a plaster ceiling, and all the water on it, you know, causes the cracks in the plaster. Mm-hmm. Well, nobody knows. And I had just done a family quiz at my kid's school, and I'd found that this guy, Mr. Baker, who taught geography, had basically been a bit lazy and got all the questions off an online site.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all clichés like, who invented the scissors, and all that thing. I know that. Everyone thinks it's Leonardo da Vinci, but scissors go back to the pyramids. And as I looked and I found another wrong answer, I thought, okay, so I found the site. I dug it out by the process of Googling. And so I sent Mr. Baker two sets of answers. I said, these are the actual answers, the truthful answers, and these are the ones you want. I would have got 100% of the ones you want. And because he was maybe ashamed or embarrassed or angry, he made us came second in the school quiz. And I thought, okay, I'm after this bloke.
Mm.
So I said to Harry, next time you're in with Mr. Baker, ask him about the tectonic plates on Mars. So Harry was quite a naughty boy and loved this.
Uh-huh.
He said, oh, please, sir, can you tell us about the tectonic plates on Mars? And Mr. Baker's answer was, shut up, Harry. That was it, you know, because obviously it was a complete curveball. He had no idea.
Mm.
Anyway, it amused me.
Yeah, you've said before that the mark of a good teacher is someone who can elicit from the class a question that they themselves don't know the answer to.
Yeah.
And that is an encapsulation of everything you've just said. You mentioned during there your career as a director, and you've described it as a good director, or a good film crew is like a human body.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they're a kind of gestalt, you know, that like warming to our theme today. I mean, that a good film crew is one entity,
mm-hmm.
Which each sort of limb of which or organ of which has a different function, so that, you know, if you like, the lighting cameraman is the eyes, and the grip is the legs or the biceps, and
mm-hmm.
Each has a different function. They all work together, and it's one of the ways we run QI the company, which is what they call a very flat hierarchy, is that everybody's an equal,
mm-hmm.
and there's just the pimple at the top, which is me, I suppose, as the chairman or the director, who is essentially there for when people get stuck. You're not really there. Nobody tells people what to do. There are tasks that need to be done, and they are farmed out to people, and usually willingly. Everybody has to do some things they don't like, of course, that's life.
Mm-hmm.
But most stuff we do, you know, people who are good at certain things get to do them. And, you know, and they find out they're good at things they didn't know they were good at, and so forth. But there's very little ordering about. There's obviously mentoring at the beginning, trying to explain how it works and what the optimal way of finding the stuff is and all that kind of thing. But it just rolls along, and, you know, it's what a well-run anything should be like, is the higher up the hierarchy you go, the more relaxed the job, because the person right at the top should be making the big strategic thing, should have plenty of time to think about stuff, not managing, not and certainly not micromanaging.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the things that's gone wrong with most things, actually, now, which is everything's a pyramid structure, you know, with somebody right at the apex who's usually a complete control freak, if not a psychopath,
yeah,
who's making all the decisions about everybody and won't anyone have any freedom at all, and it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And they're extremely stressed, overworked, close to a nervous breakdown, sometimes suicide,
mm-hmm.
Because nobody can do all that. And, you know, when I worked in telly in the 80s, wonderful controller called Brian Wenham, who became a very good friend, and, you know, we did Not the 9 o'clock News, we didn't know what we were doing. Really, nobody really told us what to do. We just got on and did it until we could find something that worked.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Brian basically was such a good controller that basically by, you know, 5:30, he was looking for somebody to have a glass of white wine with, you know. He didn't really have very much to do because he had brilliant heads of department who were running comedy and running documentaries and, you know, sport and so on. And he trusted them to do it well, and they trusted all their producers to do it well, and everyone had a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And now nobody gets to decide about anything at any level.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was talking to an ex-controller of BBC Two, who when she got there, she's like, since I was a little girl, I always wanted to be controller of BBC Two, and now I've got here, I find I have no power. You think it's, well, who, you know, cui bono, to whose advantage is any of this stuff?
Mm.
You know, the trick to running anything is hire the best people you can afford that you like and tell them to get on with it.
Yeah.
And leave them alone, because that's the way everybody, as I say, you know, when people are teaching themselves, that's when they remember stuff. So that's why QI researchers, the QI elves as they're called, are such great conversationalists, because you don't forget it. Mm-hmm. If you've spent, I remember right in the very first few days that John Mitchinson, the very first employee of QI, spent a week trying to find out what is the largest object a blue whale can swallow. And it was very difficult. It's not written down. You had to work it out.
Mm-hmm.
It was a grapefruit, you know, because they don't need to swallow big things. So they eat krill, which is sort of microscopic crustaceans.
Mm.
And that's such a joyous thing. You never forget that. Mm. You don't think, how big is a blue whale's mouth? You know, you can't forget it.
Yeah.
Because it's self-learned.
And blue whales becoming a motif in QI ever since.
Yeah.
Actually related to blue whales in that often espoused by Alan Davis, and you met Alan Davis from the Abbey National commercials you were directing there. What would be what makes a good director? What makes a sort of what is something about directing that you maybe don't know until you do it, but you wish you'd known earlier that can ensure to the best degree success?
Okay, so I think the cliche of a director is a guy in sort of, you know, thigh boots with a whip, you know, ordering people around, which is not, and no directors are any good alike that. All the directors I know are thoughtful and quiet, and you wouldn't notice who the director was on the set. The first assistant going around yelling at people.
Yeah.
You know, but the director barely speaks often. And if they do, they're thoughtful. So the main thing of directing is, like in life, prep is everything, the preparation.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody once said that all great films, whether they're a telecommercial or a movie, are made twice, once in the director's mind and once on the set.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difficult thing about directing. People often say, it must be really scary going, you know, onto a set and there's 60 people wondering, what do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
No, that's lovely. Because you're buoyed up on this fantastic raft of people you genuinely love, that you trust absolutely and implicitly, and they you. I mean, if you're a nice, you know, kind person and you know what you want, a crew will do literally anything for you.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick of it is, as I say, the struggle of directing is nothing to do with the set. That's really enjoyable. It's great fun. My sets are always lots of laughter, very high work rate, rarely finished late, always came in on budget pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Because the struggle is the 3 nights before writing the storyboard, which was agony, you know, hundreds and hundreds of little pieces of paper screwed up and you know, trying to get this one shot. When she looks at him, which shoulder is she looking over? Mm-hmm. And, oh, wait a minute, we'll be able to see the clock behind her. Kind of that.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, a two shot, that could work. And, you know, my drawings are, you know, not better than stick people. I used to do all my own storyboards. I tried having a professional storyboard, but that's what you want is what's called a shooting board, which is you've worked out that's where the camera is and that's what how long it is and all this kind of thing. If you have a professional, it looks lovely in the presentation, but you can't shoot from it. And people used to say, clients used to say, who did these? And I said, I did. You did your own storyboard? Yeah. And, of course, being a comedy director, they're funny, you know. They're a little, it's like sort of mad cartoons and little, you know. Like a sort of something out of the Beano, really.
Yeah.
So that's the thing is to have already made the film. And because obviously things change. As soon as you get on location, you realize there's a pylon in the way and you can't do that shot. And you have to, it's sometimes agony to change the film, which, as far as I'm concerned, already exists in some other universe.
Mm.
And then other than that, it's like the secret of any kind of management is, you know, hire the best people you can afford. You know, get people who are better than you in every department, including the actors. You know, there's no point in... you shouldn't be telling an actor how to do something. You should just... I'll tell you a story, for example. I did some ads with Jeff Goldblum, who's a blooming genius and a wonderful guy, out in L.A. for Holston Pills. And I'd say... You know, as you do, you're doing a few takes. Okay, Jeff, maybe a bit faster on that one, or how about you look out the window and see the lawnmower across the street, or, you know, try a few things.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, okay, last take. So, Jeff, just do one for you, mate, you know. And he'd do this thing. He'd go, oh, my God, it's so brilliant. It's so brilliant. I could never have thought of that. And it's like one of the lessons of life generally is get out of the way, you know, get out of the way. Let the right to the thing. The universe is going to do what it will. You know, you can't control it. You need to resign as managing director of the universe if you want a nice life. And get in flow, you know. That's what filming is like, is... You know, I've seen things where a good crew on Spitting Image, for example, one of the directors, who I won't name, threw a tantrum and walked out of the studio. And it was like really, really embarrassing. It's never happened again to me, just once. Wow. And he said, right, if you think you're so fucking great, you can direct it. And of course, I hadn't directed anything at that time. He stormed out, and basically the crew made the show. He was away for a day, and the floor manager... basically, you know, we went off the script and there weren't storyboards, I don't think, but we had it was all done to a soundtrack because we recorded all the script for sound only and then mimed to it. And the crew made the thing perfectly. And the director was not necessary. And he came back, he was very shamefaced the next day and he never made a fuss again.
Yeah. Bizarrely, the same thing happened with Jackie Chan on, I think, the set of Rush Hour, is that whoever was directing that just abdicated his duties.
Yeah.
And so there's footage of Jackie just going, okay, well, I'll just start directing. If you hit that, if I slide down the pole there and do that. And seemingly that might be why it became such a successful franchise, is because the most talented person used those talents instead of being sort of subjugated or put into like a little pigeonhole. You're just for that purpose. You don't have any other value.
Yeah, and I think, the interesting other thing about directing well is that you leave your ego, you know, at the door. Like any art is the better for it. Again, get out of the way. This, you know, you want to access the truth, the universe, and you want to channel the right thing to do rather than saying, that was my idea, I'm better than you, all that kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
And I used to have this theory for years and years that that's true of all artists, is that when they're working, if they're any good, they have no ego, they have no voice in their head. They're just basically, they're sort of melding in some way with the universal truths. It's still a struggle, but then it's not about them. And I thought, if I said, for example, you know, Picasso could be a complete bastard in his private life, you know, lots of mistresses and behave like a pig and, you know, throw tantrums or whatever he did. But I bet when he was in his studio, he was completely so absorbed in the work that he didn't have an ego. And years later, I found this quote from him. I just invented that, just Picasso as an example of somebody who's a difficult person, but a great artist. And I found this quote, he's saying, When I enter my studio, I leave my personality outside the door as a Muslim leaves his slippers outside the mosque. I thought, oh.
That's perfect. It's a perfect way to approach all sort of collaborative work. And you said before that being a producer is about collaboration. It's about sort of creating together. And as you've illustrated, you can't do that if one person feels like they supersede every other.
Yeah, I don't believe in the auteur theory. I think that, again, it's... there's a great quote in the Tao Te Ching that a leader is, I'll have to paraphrase this, a leader is, I'll have to look it up, Dom.
We can insert it in the edit.
A leader is... Something like worst when people despise him, second worst when
people love him.
No, people respect and obey him, or something, and best when he does nothing at all. So that when the job is done, the people will say we did this ourselves. It's something like that. It's a very. And when I first read that, I thought, oh my God, I've just crossed a bridge here. I've learned something really, really important, because most of the Tao is really impenetrable. Ancient Chinese is very difficult to translate, and so it depends entirely on which translation you get, whether it's at all comprehensible or indeed enjoyable.
Sure, and the very nature of translation and the problems therein, everything from like sort of geopolitical negotiations to religious scriptures, it shows the importance of accurate language. As I mean, wars have been fought over arguably misrepresentations of Bible quotes, for example, or rights have been taken away because of that. Yes, there's no segue there necessarily. Unless you can find one.
No, I can't.
Well, you mentioned spitting image, and I wrote my university dissertation on analysing late-night American talk show comedy monologues and their political evolution. My friend Kate wrote hers on the satire boom in Britain, and I said you were coming on the show, and I asked if she had any particular question, and it was this. Was your intention behind Spitting Image and other satirical works to change a system and offer an effective critique that helps to change the real world, or was it simply good material that the audience resonates with? In other words, was it intended as a form of activistic change, or was it just about creating good comedy?
There certainly would have been some people, not usually on the writing team or the performers, who would have hoped that we would, you know, nudge some political change along. You know, down in the workshop where the puppets made, there were some pretty, you know, pretty far out lefties. Mm-hmm. But there was all shades of political opinion in the country, and apart from, I don't think there was anyone seriously very right wing. But you know, Ian Heslop's quite a, you know, he's a bit of a soft Tory in a way, you know, a sort of, you know, a bit like Richard Ingram's, a sort of Christian anarchist kind of, you know, libertarian. I'm very middle. I'm very centrist. I think Roger and Peter were probably, you know, to the left. Yeah, definitely. But no, it's not like, that's not what we were doing. It's like a kind of, you know, the word advertising means to draw to the attention of. You know, that's what good advertising is, all it's really doing. And that's really what political, you know, topical comedy is doing. It's just pointing things out so that people can make up their own mind. And you should be laughing so much that you can't, it's only later that it sinks in what what the point was being made. And as Roger Law used to say, satire don't do fuck all. We made absolutely no difference. If we made any difference at all, we gave Mrs. Thatcher more credibility and more power, because she hated the programme. But it's a funny thing. When you satirise strong people, they think it's great, generally. And people who are a bit weedy, they're the ones who really get hurt. So that with David and Owen, David Steele, obviously, David Owen was the sort of smooth bully, and Steele was the tiny little chappy like this. And David Steele, who I met not long ago, said, no, I didn't mind it at all. My family didn't like it, but he was reportedly very hurt by it and used to say, I'm half an inch taller than Neil Kinnock. But David Owen thought it was hilarious. And I think, you know, that if you satirise strong people as being strong, they just get stronger. And, you know, Mrs. Thatcher was re-elected during Spitting Image's tenure. John Major was elected, even though we mocked the hell out of him. Mm-hmm. It didn't make any difference. But, and I think the unintended consequences of Spitting Image, one is that all the particularly teenagers in the country were incredibly well-informed about politics in a way that they could name, you know, 10 members of the cabinet without thinking about it, and 4 members of the shadow cabinet, which you can't, none of us could do today. And the other thing is that in a very similarly divided, you know, because the miners' strike divided the country down the middle like Brexit has, it cheered people up when really 2 years before people were rioting in Toxteth and London and, you know, in Hackney and, you know, before the Falklands War, Mrs. Thatcher's administration was really hanging by a thread. You know, there could have easily been a revolution. So the Falklands War was first what, you know, brought more people on side. And then, and definitely Spitting Image, 15 million people every Sunday night, you know, 13 shows a year, that's a lot of stuff.
It was only, as you pointed out before, and pointed out to Tory ministers who complained at the time, 13.5 million elected them into office, and you were getting 15 million every week. So you were getting more votes than they were on a weekly basis.
Yeah, absolutely. And similarly, when I was taken to task by a senior editor of The Sun, saying, you know, at a private eye lunch, she said, "You shouldn't be allowed to do this. You know, I've got 4 million readers who disagree with what you're doing, and so I've got 15 million viewers. You know, who's more democratic?" And it was very interesting because the great thing about Spitting Image, it was completely inclusive. So it, I remember when it started to get really popular in the sort of third series, the ads in the centre breaks were all for things like Apple Macintosh and, you know, Mercedes and so on, because it was very, lots of ABC ones watch it, you know, civil servants and Royal Family and, yeah, people in the services. And but it also got right down to, you know, what they call C2Ds, you know, plumbers and taxi drivers and craftsmen.
Sure.
Because there was something in it for everybody, you know. There was sport and there was, you know, acting jokes and not all politics. So, no, it was... it's just... I like doing things for the sake of the thing itself. You just thought... Me and Ben Elton, when we first came across, we just thought, this is just... This is going to be amazing. This is such... So it was a shock in the first series when everyone hated it. And it got terrible reviews. None of my friends would speak to me. They thought it was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's such a common thing. That's happens to me a lot, is the first couple of years people think I've gone insane. And then 20 years later they say, oh, I like the early funny ones when they were really original. Oh, shut up. Like Woody Allen, you know. Exactly. I like the early funny ones, yeah.
Well, as you've said before, disaster is a gift.
Yeah. Thank you. You've done your research. I'm very impressed.
Oh, good. I like to do my homework.
Well, like I say it's all in the prep, isn't it?
Really? Absolutely, absolutely. So, talking on that theme, what's your take on Jonathan Coe's critique of satire, that it can become a distraction and trivialise, thereby channelling anger into laughter rather than activism?
Well, hey, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I'm not... an activist in that public sense. I reckon I did my time before the mast, you know, sort of 15 years doing that kind of thing. I don't feel it made any difference apart from cheering people up,
mm-hmm.
Which is a good thing to do. And my personal philosophy now is, you know, it's like when you get all those charity leaflets through the letterbox, and who do you give to? I'm naturally sure. A give to people on the street, and you can't solve every problem in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't your job. I know activists think it is, that whatever it is they're interested in, that's what I do. And great, I respect those people.
Mm.
But your job is to fix you. It's like, you know, before you help other people, put your own oxygen mask on.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Fix yourself and then things. So my thing is, particularly, the more polarized things get, the nicer I am to everybody. The more I try to listen, the more I try to find the human being underneath the sort of raft of opinions, many of which are misinformed or mad or wrong or not what I think. And that's what's got me through the last few years, is like, you know, just because your opinion is insane doesn't mean you're not a nice guy, you know, or a good dad or a good mum or whatever. And I found that to be more or less universally true. And I think that I believe that most people are basically good. If they behave badly, it's because they're frightened or they're angry or because they've had a bad day or whatever. And you look at public figures and you think, this is really embarrassing the way these people are talking. They are like, I don't know any real people like that. They're just lying. They don't really believe most of the things they're saying. And they're obviously playing to the worst instincts of everybody, you know, playing to fear and division and tribalism and anger and, you know, despair is awful. But it's a dumb show, you know. To me, that's like, it's like you watch it like you watch a crap television show. It's like, well, it's nothing to do with me, fuck 'em.
Yeah.
You've got to get on with your life. And, you know, that at a level of ordinary, which is where I sit, you know, most people are pretty nice all the time. And even when they're not nice, it's amazing how you can out-nice them.
Yeah.
You just go on under the racist opinions or the grumpiness or whatever. You just keep on listening and talking. Eventually they cheer up because everybody likes a cheerful person.
Absolutely. I encountered this even at the sort of youngest level. There was a 7 or 8-year-old in a class who, just at the very start of the outbreak, he was a very sweet, very lovely child. And yet was espousing some of the anti-Asian sentiments that were around that time. And I questioned him on it, and I sort of dug deeper into the why are you saying this? It's unlike you. And it boiled down to, he was worried about missing school, and he was worried about spending all the time at home, and it came down to fear. Mm. And that was a lovely, from an educational point of view, to talk about otherism, and sort of just because they don't support Liverpool doesn't make them a bad person. But it does. You're absolutely right in that the worst in human behaviour can often be traced back to a very simple sort of primal lack or need of fear or distress. And if you can soothe that, then that's how you can help change minds and change nations as a result. It takes a village, but a village is made up of individuals. And it does seem true that whereas one party would look for traitors, another party might look for converts. And by reaching for that humanity is the way to move forward.
Well, yeah, again, this is something I happen to think. I don't know. The thing about philosophy is it doesn't have to be true, but it has to be effective for you. It has to mean that if it helps you lead a more optimal life. And one of the things about the sort of polarization of modern politics all over the world really is when things go wrong, it's natural for people, well, I don't know if it's natural, but it's what they do, is they look round for blame. Who did this? Whose fault is this? And when you've got demagogues, they say, that's the European Union, or it's black people, or it's gays, you know, or it's the wokes. You know, there's somebody, you know, why is my life so shit? Why is my marriage ropey? Why are my teenage children annoying? You know, why is my job so shit? Mm-hmm. Who did this? Oh, it's the Labour Party. Don't know. Oh, yeah, fuck them. Mm. And the thing is, that one of the things you need to do in life if you're going to live it well, is to take responsibility for everything. Mm-hmm. It's your fault, okay? That's the way to look at it. Fix you first, you know. You don't like your job, leave it, you know. Your marriage is ropey. Have you considered being a bit more considerate? You know, how much of it might be your fault, the difficult person you're married to? And yeah, because people are, you know, everybody's life is difficult. It's a struggle to be alive. And looking for blame is so wrong. It's such a mistake. Mm-hmm. The thing is, you look at yourself first, you know, fix yourself, and then things will start to work. And that's what I've been doing, really, since I fell into a despond in age 42, you know, when I hit my midlife skids. And that's what I've been doing, is recalibrating every dial that I can to lose some of these ridiculous sort of shackles that we're all hanging off every limb.
Absolutely. And as you say, to put your own oxygen mask on before you try and attend to others. When speaking to Noam Chomsky on the show, I asked him about what books he read to his children when he was growing up. And he said the books he read, he wanted to pass on to his children and read them to him. But looking back at them, he realised just how racist and awful they were. And the books growing up, he was read. And he said his parents were very liberal. And it wasn't meant with any malice. It's just the attitudes have changed. What are books you grew up having read to you or reading that you loved, and have you been able to pass those same stories on to your children?
I don't think that's not really a very easy question to do. My dad was in the Navy. I don't remember him ever reading stories. Probably he might have done, but he wasn't around very much. I'm sure my mum did, but I can't honestly remember, apart from me, I don't know what she would have read to us as children. She was definitely the person who lit my educational fire, as it were, because we were always travelling as kids on troop ships and very long car journeys and moving school every year, because my father's good at what he did and was continually promoted. And so we were often, say, on long sea journeys. My mum would teach us by basically in a series of quizzes so that everything was fun. And that's when I finally got to a proper prep school at about nearly 10. It was like, really, you've got to sit in rows and do what you're told, and that's the wrong answer. Well, hang on, what's happened to all the fun? It was really quite a shock, actually. And this is the thing, you repeat the pattern of your parents, don't you? So my dad basically is a really nice guy, but he went away for long periods and he came back with presents. That's what he did. And that's what I did unwittingly as a commercials director. I was away for the early years of my children, I was away a lot every year abroad, making lots of money, coming back with presents. Mm-hmm. Which it took me, you know, a long time to work out how crazy that was. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do a lot of reading, but I remember the thing that I used to have fun, whatever the book was, mm-hmm. I would just insert the word sausage in every so often, instead of the naughty witch, you know, it would be the naughty sausage, and they go, oh, Dad said sausage. That was really good fun. But that was whatever it was, there was always a sausage in there somewhere.
Yeah. And that's a motto that doesn't need context.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I'll be copying the sausage route. None of this is broadcastable. Moving from that to Johnny English defined a lot of my childhood. I loved the movie to the extent that on the DVD features of it, there was a little observational quest in order to unlock the deleted scenes, and you had to do this repeatedly until you got them right, to the point that I know the number plate is OY02USH because it is seared into my cerebral. What was your involvement with the film?
Well, I was fired from the first two, basically.
Okay.
I was originally hired as a kind of script consultant on the first one, and then I sort of gradually got promoted and eventually was was going to be the director. Mm-hmm. And I'd said all the time, the script isn't right. It's not ready to go yet. And they kept saying, what's the matter with you? Why don't you just get on and shoot it? Richard Curtis will fix it in the edit, they used to say. And I kept on saying, no, I'm sorry, I'm not ready. And then I thought, oh, I'm just being such a baby here. Why don't I take a risk? You know, I'll have a go. I'm sure I can fix some of it on the day.
Yeah.
And I'd kept on saying that script isn't right. And Rowan had sent it to a friend of his, Piers Fletcher, who now produces QI, mm-hmm. and said, John's always going on about how the script isn't any good. What do you think? And Piers put two envelopes in. And he says, you know, the first one just said, inside the other envelope, is I'm telling the truth as far as I know it, and if you're nervous about it, don't open the envelope. And inside, he had a fierce critique of how he thought the script didn't hang together, the prop wasn't very good, and not enough jokes, whatever it was. I never saw the letter. Mm-hmm. And so Rowan pulled out of the movie.
Wow.
And working title, blame me. I said, no, I didn't speak to Ron. He said, ignored all my advice. It was Piers, basically, who told him, but they sacked me. Anyway, after that, then I was hired for the second one. Was it the third one? John English Reborn, which is that? Is that the third one?
I believe it's the third one.
Mm. Anyway, so eventually, Rowan said, we're going to do another one. Do you want to come back aboard? Which is a pattern with me and Rowan. This often happens. And I said, yeah, okay, but I'm not going to work with those writers because I think we can do a better job. I think if I basically do what I often do is I'll write the template and you tell me where you can make it better. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll do it together. So he said, okay, and that was set up with working title. And by that time, though, that the pattern of Johnny English had been established, what I would have made is basically Barclaycard the movie. That was what I mm-hmm. tried to get Barclaycard to give me the money for.
Which is where the character originated, of course.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And it's amazing they don't get money from Johnny English, really. But yeah. I wanted to make Blackadder stroke Barclaycard, you know, a tough, credible, but the thing about Richard Latham, Barclaycard adds, is he's too clever for his own good, but he is very clever and he's very stylish. Mm-hmm. The mistakes he makes is because he's very, very smart, not because he's a blundering idiot, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas what Working Title wanted was basically Mr. Bean, the spy, you know.
Yeah.
So it doesn't do it for me. I took my daughters to the first one. They were sort of 11 and 9 or something. They screamed with laughter all the way through. They thought it was marvellous. Mm-hmm. But that's about the level of it, really. I mean, I could have... And the one that I wrote, the treatment that I wrote for the third one was that basically English finds himself basically teaching in a prep school in a leafy, you know, Herefordshire grounds with mm-hmm. a wall around it, mm-hmm. which actually turns out to be in the middle of Saudi Arabia. They've created this... thing. It's in the middle of nowhere, and it's basically a safe house for operatives of MI7 who've basically blotted their copybook. He's been locked away in this thing where he teaches geography and shooting. to these boys. And they're all the children of oligarchs, because the oligarchs have realised if they want their children to rule the world, there's nothing better than taking them to an English prep school and beating them and, you know, having, you know, inappropriate things done to them in the evenings and to toughen them up, you know, so that they then be masters of the universe. Anyway, he's sprung from that because the department want him back. And while he's been at this school, he's got a mentor who, the judo teacher, is a sort of mystical philosopher who teaches him to fly in a yogic fashion and basically tells him, up to now, your whole life has been a complete arsehole. You've been a complete prat the whole time. You're an idiot and you're a creep and all that sort of thing. And he basically finds enlightenment. He realises, yes, I'm like a little ridiculous Mr. Bean character, and really I can be a hero. I can be a properly good guy and save the world. And so to get it back to that original character,
yeah,
tough and scary and genuinely sexy, incredibly suave and angry, very angry and dangerous. I wanted to make a thing that was really funny but hung together as a credible plot. I don't think John English does. I mean, why do people... You know, John English does something ridiculous. You know, he falls down a hole or something. Everyone just stares at him, go, ooh. You know, the Prime Minister, stare, or whatever. I'm not familiar with the genre.
Yeah,
anyway, I sacked from that because, you know, I couldn't think the punchline. It was a really, really good treatment. It was full of fantastically good scenes.
Mm.
But they couldn't stand it. You know, cause they didn't want to do... They wanted Mr. Bean. It wasn't anything like Mr. Bean. And they used the excuse, because you didn't think of an end, that we're going to get rid of you. They paid me. They paid me well for the treatment. But I thought... And that, by that time, I thought, oh, fucking idiots, I don't care. Fine, if they don't want me, I won't be bothered. Whereas before, it would have been 10 years of misery and anguish. And, but that's what I think now. People sack me, I think, OK, your loss, fine.
Yeah. Well, I hope we just heard the story of Johnny English 4. I hope that they were invited back for the...
No, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen anyway. You know, Rowan's, you know, happily engaged with a daughter and probably doesn't want to do any work if he possibly has to.
Well, he's just done Man versus Bee.
That's true. Yeah.
Do you agree with his view that comedy and the ability to sort of this freedom of speech argument that he makes so passionately of that offence and comedy are kind of hand in hand to some extent?
I respect Rowan's stance. It's to say that stuff, but it's not really what I think. I mean, I don't set out to offend people. I know that's a sort of standard BBC response. We never set out to offend, but it's not what I try to do. And I don't think I could do Spitting Image now. I don't feel that strongly about stuff. But I certainly try not to offend anyone, really. And I think it's possible to do. To be funny without hurting people.
Yeah.
I once reviewed a book by Howard Jacobson about the nature of comedy, where his contention is basically everything funny is cruel. I so disagree with that. When you watch little children giggling about something, it's perfectly possible to be innocent humour's fine. And, you know, I always like jokes which, and a guy asked the question in the show yesterday, you know, when do we get to call a spade again, and, you know, why can't you can't make jokes about anything, this is ridiculous, you know. Well, obviously, if you really want to upset transgender people, it's pretty easy to think of jokes that they would find difficult. Well, why would you want to do that? You know, live and let live, my thing. And you know, I think it's But obviously, the trouble is, once you get that, you know, lines in the sand, dig your heels in stuff, once you get polarisation, it is, you know, the thing is, you're either with us or you're a Nazi. And then everything goes to the extremes, you know, that because you've both got, you know, you get extreme left and extreme right and extreme woke and extreme anti-woke, rather than where most people are, is sort of in the middle, you know. Say most people are pretty nice and they think, okay, you know, it's up to, you know, it's your life, if that's what you want, then fine, I respect you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I try and stay out of these things as much as possible. You know, the universe is a big place, there's plenty of other things to be funny about.
we're in total alignment. But and when you're saying that, yeah, little children giggling at anything. I often describe it as being in a room, sometimes hosting like an improv or panel show with some of the best surrealist comic minds, because the ideation they come up with is phenomenal, and it's a really beautiful thing to see them sort of experiment with what is funny, and to almost a Dada-esque extent. And there seems to be the majority of money in sketch comedy in Britain seems to be with children's television. Therefore, a lot of great writers writing for children's TV and sketch comedy. And because they're limited, because you can't swear or have nudity or excessive violence or non-cartoonish violence, things like that, you can't rely on just saying, like, fuck as a punchline.
Yeah.
You have to think outside that. And because of that, you get this a wonderful sort of, often quite surreal, the whole thing about you should never do your first idea. You do the first 10 ideas you think of, and then you do the 11th one,
yeah,
and it's something original. And that sort of limitation aids fantastic creativity. And it seems to feed similar into your career, that you've said before that you like to be ahead of the curve. And you mentioned earlier in this interview that the first season is often poorly reviewed, and then a couple of seasons later, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened. Why didn't we invest sooner?
Mm.
As we've spoken before, it's your 39th year at The Fringe. And you've been a comedy producer predominantly and in the world for decades and decades. What is something about comedy producing in particular that you learnt whilst doing that you wish a younger John Lloyd would know?
Gosh, I don't know the answer to that. Well, I mean, I suppose, going back to what we're saying, I suppose that, you know, that quality is the other side of difficulty. That's going to happen. Disaster is a gift. You know, the thing is, you'll have terrible things happen to you. People will stitch you up. They'll betray you. They'll treat you very badly. But that's okay, because it'll mean you'll change, and usually for the better. You'll discover something new. Certainly, I wish that I hadn't been so upset every time I was fired, you know, by Douglas, by Rowan. You know, it happened a lot, and, you know, it hurt me a lot at the time. But looking back, it's just so, I was so lucky that those things happened, because every single time, you know, I'm quite lazy. If I hadn't been fired from all that, I'd probably still be producing Just a Minute, you know, as the third producer, starting in 74. And so what's that? Nearly 50 years ago, I could have just been still doing that. A perfectly nice life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't require a lot, you know, if you've got enough money for a couple of pints in the evening and, you know, somewhere to live. But as a result of this, you know, extraordinary mad journey to all these different places, and nearly all of them have been a direct result of being fired by somebody. I mean, the reason I went into television presenting and shooting ads was essentially because Helen Fielding sacked me as her boyfriend, broke my heart, and I thought, I'm not going to be a producer anymore. I hate it. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to do everything, you know. I'm not going to be the last person in the office and the least well paid, and so I'm going to have some larks.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, mainly that, you know. It's like, just keep going, mate. That's the thing, you know. It's going to be very difficult, and you're going to get badly hurt. But don't be hurt. Just say, that's your loss. If you don't want to work with me, that's fine. I've got plenty of other things to do.
Well, I think that's the perfect place to conclude. John Lloyd, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thanks, Dom. It's been really good fun.
Thank you.